And essentially, that's a grant that can capitalize a revolving loan fund pool, and then you can make loans or sub-grants from that pool to continue to clean up. If you have multiple sites, that might be the way to approach it. I'm sorry? Revolving loan fund is $1 million per entity, but coalition. So city, state, county, that each of them could apply for up to $1 million. So that could be a total of $3 million. I'm happy to talk to you at the end of the session about this. The deadline for those is November 14th. So if you can't do it this year, it's never too early to start for next year. Now, that doesn't mention another very important grant, which we talked about, too, the job training. And so Sharon Beard from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences will talk to you a little bit about the Minority Worker Training Program and some of the grants that she's been working on.
Is there a website?
Yes. www.epa.gov/brownfields. And there's a handout on a couple of the ends of the rows. That's on our website. I just ask you to only take one, and if you want to give me your card, I'm happy to send you a PDF of it. You can download it from our website also.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Sharon Beard, and I'm the industrial hygienist with the Worker Education and Training Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. We're part of the National Institutes of Health. There are no disclosures for myself, Donnell, and Laurel in this presentation. I wanted to share with you a little bit about the session objectives. And one of the things that I want to talk to you about is that we have worked with the City of Detroit and with ATSDR on various different projects across the country. But in reference to dealing with brownfields and environmental justice, we wanted to talk about specific projects that are involved with focusing on environmental justice issues around communities. And one of the communities that we're going to be talking about is what's going on in Detroit. Brownfields in Detroit. I don't know how many of you know a lot about Detroit. Of course, it's a heavily industrialized area, and because of the industrialization and the downfall in reference to a lot of different types of facilities, of course, dealing with the automobile plants, there's been a lot of major significant areas dealing with brownfields and redevelopment in Detroit. And one of the biggest things is that EPA and several other federal government organizations, local and state grants, have made major investments to help with the foundation of evaluation of efforts and funding, assessment, cleanup, and job training activities in those areas. And with the City of Detroit, and we're sorry that we couldn't get a representative from the City of Detroit to come and talk about some of these projects, but we wanted to really show you what is definitely still going on there. Over the last 5 years have really implemented over 113 successful brownfield projects in Detroit. And we wanted to really talk to you about public health and environmental justice because it remains a broad community interest in the area. Now, I wanted to make sure I showed you a little bit about NIEHS, and I think some of you, of course, if you're in the environment section, you know a little bit about what we do and how we operate. But NIEHS is the premier environmental health biomedical research institute of the government. And we've been doing work dealing with biomedical research for quite a long time. One of the things that we've really been focusing on is this whole issue of prevention research. And we've done that through several different grants and projects over the years. Of course, one of the major ones is our Environmental Justice Partnerships for Communication. We actually have a new program, which is called Partnerships for Environmental Public Health, where we're trying to encompass all of those programs together. That's our community-based prevention intervention, research grants, built environment, job training, and all of those. And then, of course, dealing with the whole issue of public education and involvement, that's where the Worker Education and Training Program comes in. And it's actually in the active in development training of development of training programs to protect workers engaged in hazardous materials remediation, containment, and emergency response. In Detroit, what we try to do with the worker training program is really help communities and organizations to address their needs. And what we did in Detroit was focusing on some areas dealing with cleaning up and training organizations to actually do cleanup in those areas. And the best approach that we've had is to really fund organizations who actually have a vision to do this in their communities. Whether it's a local community-based organization, whether it's a union-based apprenticeship training program, or workers in the community who want to clean up their community, what we try to do is partner with these groups and actually provide them with funding to do the health and safety training and then enable them to reach their vision by cleaning up those communities and addressing public health issues. And we help them by designing and developing and providing job training programs to do that. And what I wanted to share with you is some resources that we have at NIEHS to really do that. Within the worker training program, we've done multiple technical workshops dealing with health and safety, brownfields, dealing with hurricane response, pandemic flu. We actually have a strong network of peer trainers, and that's really been the focus and the gold standard of this training program, is that we bring in environmental health specialists, occupational health and safety specialists, and we work to actually train peer rank and file individuals to actually move up and actually come from their communities and their work sites to train folks in their area to do this type of work. We've actually focused on a consortium approach to training, where we actually try to build regional and national training programs where people can learn from each other and share lessons learned so that they, when they start a new project in another area, they'll have some background and they'll have some lessons learned to take so that they won't be starting fresh dealing with these types of issues. We have a national clearinghouse for worker health and safety training where all of the curricula for our training program. And we've been doing training since 1986, so we have curricula, thousands of curricula dealing with health and safety training, dealing with brownfields and public health, that's available on our clearinghouse, free of charge. You just have to go on and download the curricula. And we also have a lot of the what we consider holistic approaches to job training, where we focus on the life skills and also the other things that has to go into making sure that we're training individuals to clean up their communities, but we also want to give them the other skills necessary. And we've been doing it for over 20 years. And I want to now turn it over, we lost a couple of slides, I think, but I wanted to talk briefly about the Minority Worker Training Program as this model that we've used and working with Detroit, with Donnell in Detroit. And we have actually been funding the Minority Worker Training Program for many years. And this particular program has focused on increasing the number of underrepresented minorities who are involved in environmental remediation and hazardous waste, teaching them life skills, and helping them to enter into environmentally career-oriented fields and also into apprenticeship programs. And since we've been doing this since 1995 with the brownfields and a primarily focus on brownfields and minority communities, we've trained over 6,700 students. I think this thing is cycling on its own.
Oh.
We'll go back when we get finished.
We apologize.
And we've trained over 6,700 students within these programs, and our average job placement rate has been around 68% for these training programs. And the biggest thing is that these students are actually actively cleaning up their communities because they were not working or were incarcerated, so now they're actually engaged in doing the cleanup. And what we're going to now do is turn it over to Donnell so she can share with you some particular programs and initiatives that they're doing in Detroit. Thank you.
So again, you know, what's so great about this panel is we have, one, partnerships with the State Health Department, ATSTR, NIEHS, and Detroiters for a Clean Environment. So it's great to have Donnell Wilkins here from Detroit to share some of the work that they've been doing. And they were also host to one of our best Brownfields Conference national conferences this year in May. We had over 5,500 people from the United States, developers, environmental folks, community justice, and environmental justice advocates from around the country and around the world. And it's not too early to be thinking about November 16th to 18th, 2009. The National Brownfields Conference is going to be in New Orleans. We would love for more public health folks to be there and to talk brownfields with our communities. Donnell.
So the slides have become a little psychotic and are rotating on their own. So if you want me to advance for you, I can, or if you're a control freak like me.
No, I'm not a control freak. Please help me out. So I'm happy to relinquish that. So again, I'm Donnell Wilkins, not Dr.
Nathan from the City of Detroit, who was not able to be here, and I'm really happy that I was invited to sort of plug in and speak up about what's going on in the City of Detroit. I am the founder, founding director of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice, a nonprofit organization that primary focus is to build capacity and empower people to clean up their community environmentally. We've been around since 1994, and we're well known for our history of advocacy. And like many other environmental justice organizations, shutting down incinerators, fighting against things that are inappropriate in our communities, promoting civic engagement, promoting public health, and really, really trying to build the leadership and the voice of the people who are disproportionately impacted by brownfields and other things. And just so those who are not familiar with the environmental justice issue, that communities of color and the poor have disproportionately borne the burden of environmental problems, such as brownfield sites and living near those things, and also bore the burden or has continued to bear the burden around disproportionate health impacts as a result of exposure to toxic waste and other things inappropriate to land use. Thanks. So for a long time, our motto has been take a stand for the land in the hood, and our goal is to make certain that what we're speaking about and what we raise are something that people can understand, we reach people where they are, and we build them up from that from that level, assuming that there is need for that. And what I'm going to do is really put into context what's happening in the City of Detroit. So I'll show you a few images in terms of what we consider brownfield sites. I'll talk a little bit about some of the work that we have done and the vision that we have and the relationships that we have built, the partnerships that we've built to achieve those visions. So what you're going to see are just a few images for the next few slides that kind of give you some idea. And while we're going through those slides, I want to just put it into context how much of a problem brownfields have been for the City of Detroit. Because we're known for building cars and we're the Motor City and the car capital, we have a legacy of problems related to that industry. Back in the mid-1990s, the former mayor, Dennis Archer, began to inventory what he thought were brownfield sites and stopped at 45,000. You can continue. They really think that there's really as much as 60 to 65,000 contaminated or perceived to be contaminated sites inside the City of Detroit. So they're dispersed throughout the city, so much so that the mayor designated the entire city a brownfield site. We are going to speak a little bit about Southwest Detroit in particular, because this is where ATSDR and EPA and others have decided to sort of test out a pilot project, which Laurel will talk a little bit more about later in this presentation. So for us, what has motivated us? Public health has motivated us. The improvement of public health and the health of our community has been our greatest motivation. We believe that one way to get at improving public health is to address where people live, where they work, where they worship, where they are educated. This map indicates every dot indicates a lead poisoned child throughout the City of Detroit as just one example. And I need to say this, it's not because they're all living in lead-based painted houses and people are eating paint chips. It is more than that. They are living next to incinerators that burn, among other things, heavy metals like lead, underground storage tanks that used to contain leaded gasoline, live next to freeways that emit lead, used to emit leaded gasoline, and of course that deposits somewhere. They live next to metal fabrication companies and all kinds of things. So just so that you'll have an idea why we do what we do. This is just an example of one of the facilities that we have, I'm happy to say, have successfully shut down this year. It's the largest municipal waste-to-energy incinerator in the country, some say the world. And we're pleased that the former mayor of Detroit has agreed among all his other issues, he did something really good when he left. We love him, though. He agreed to discontinue the contract with Philip Morris and other folks who own this facility in terms of burning the trash. And so we're looking forward to finding some reuse, appropriate reuse for this facility, among others. But this is the face of our movement. It is about protecting the most vulnerable and as health professionals, you do see this in different avenues of your work, I'm certain, how to address the issues of chronic disease and other things. What is the relationship to what we're talking about and what you do? And I hope that by the time we're done, you'll be able to see clearly what those relationships and opportunities are. So, what we learned, though, in midstream is that we cannot do this work without a vision. And though we have kind of, we entered into our work with sort of approaching this thing as what we don't want, what we don't like, what we don't need, it is much more healthier to approach it in terms of what do we need, what's the vision, if we achieved environmental justice, what would it look like? So in our 10-year anniversary as an organization, we begin to really think about if the sky was the limit, what would we do in terms of making Detroit a healthier, livable, more exciting place to live and thrive in for everyone. So we came up with what we call the BUD, Build Up Detroit. It's a vision that's sustainable, it's green, that embraces attracting green industry, innovative industry, embraces the idea of building capacity of residents to engage in the revitalization efforts of their community using a green vision and approach, and creating something exciting and wonderful for young people who decide who will make a decision whether or not to leave their community. We hope that they will stay and create even longer roots, deeper roots. So we have opportunities. We want to change this vision. But we think that there are opportunities that, like others have mentioned, brownfield redevelopment and other activities will bring to our community that will create this new division that will do all the other things that we've discussed. And I'm really happy to say, because of our relationships with NIEHS and private foundations, we have leveraged a lot more money to move towards a vision than we have to fight against stuff. And we are pleased to announce that as of 2 weeks ago, we've raised about $1 million to really plan this thing out. And I can't think of a better group of people than community residents leading this effort and empowered to do this. We're not waiting around for others to come and help us. We call ourselves Detroiters working for environmental justice for a purpose. We're not victims. We're not incapable of doing these things. We just need access to information and the resources to make it happen. And I want you to think about in your local communities, who are those kind of people that exist in your communities. So our plan includes creating a sustainable center that's something that's real, that people can come into and really learn and vision and create and actually make happen and put their hands to the wheel. And it is really an exciting time for us at this moment, because we can't think of any place that Detroit will go but up. So I want to focus a little bit on our job training program under the minority worker training. We call it Green Jobs. And it's about developing the capacity of our community to engage in the reconstruction and revitalization of their communities. Aside from learning hazardous waste cleanup and all the things that help to address the legacy of inappropriate land use and location of facilities that emit pollutants and other toxins and created the problems for us, we're also thinking forward. We're adding to the base of our training those things that everyone is talking about. You can't turn on the television and not hear about you know, the need to transition from a pollution-based economy to a sustainable green economy. What does that mean? We want to make certain that the people in our communities are not left out, because unfortunately we have been the host of these kind of problems far too long, bearing the burden and rarely benefit from the opportunities. And we're saying we want to remove this notion that people in our communities don't have the capabilities of engaging in employment and entrepreneurial opportunities to help to restore or revitalize their communities. But we really want to change that image, and we think we're well on our way to make that happen through things like this. But it takes partnerships, and we're not ignorant to the fact that we can do this by ourselves. We cannot. But we have a long history, and we have leveraged those relationships. And this is these are examples of the kinds of partners that we have leveraged in terms of making that reality something real. And these are the real partners. We have developed relationships with the Southeast Michigan Sustainable Business Forum of Southeast Michigan, the Sustainable Research Group, City of Detroit, Institute of Local Self-Reliance, the University of Michigan, Organized Labor, NIHS, and other funders are at the table, and of course, community. And we are excited about the new partners and the new projects that ATSDR brings, and EPA and others bring to the table to help us carry this part of our vision forward. So thank you, and I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Oh, sorry. So never wanting to miss an opportunity to talk about the action model, I want to show you how we're using this in Southwest Detroit. And we developed this with Dr. Vincent Nathan, who was formerly the City of Detroit's Director of Environmental Affairs and was going to deliver the presentation. As we all know, there's been some interesting political flux in Detroit. So I'm representing the City of Detroit as a partner, and partnership with Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. The slides have, and we apologize, they've come out sort of randomly with different backgrounds, but I realize this reminds me of, we went hiking in the Anza Borrego Desert. It was only about 97. For us Midwesterners, that was really warm. But it said, oh, this is sort of fitting. It reminds me of being here, and it's so beautiful. But we went into Detroit in April and said, we've got this little model, and Dr. Nathan wanted to focus on the east side of Detroit, and Danelle and I have talked about that's really where sort of the bulk of contaminated sites and issues are. And in the middle of the east side of Detroit is Harbor Hills Marina, which has million-dollar homes with a chemical stack from Petrochem. The woman looking out her window was a prime example of what the view is from the million-dollar homes. And there can be still some exposure issues, perhaps, or a great opportunity for health department to do some risk communication in this community, or just looking at what the community can do in terms of where we live, and how we approach redevelopment. We are working with the development community in Detroit now that we have a new motivation to go in and really build up this action model. We'll be going back, I think, mid-December, working with Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice and all the other people that want to be involved. One example, we went in and Dr. Nathan brought a group of folks together. You saw one of them in the picture. It's a small core group of people that are very concerned about environmental issues in Detroit. And he said, we want to talk about Harbor Hills, and they said, we want to talk about Southwest Detroit. So this is another example of where we as professionals have to listen to the community. And what we learn is that the action model can be applied in Southwest Detroit, but there's no reason why Danelle and I can't cover the whole city, because this is a community-led effort. This is the zip code in particular in Southwest Detroit that they want to look at. And as Liz has explained, we first organize the development community. That's always our first step. And then we go through these four steps. Number one, what are the issues in the community? We need to know. How can redevelopment address the issues? Always step two. And these first two questions are very easy for community members to answer. We can't get into the park. There's a fence because there's arsenic contamination. The redevelopment approach would be to take care of that problem. And sometimes we have to help people with, well, what's your health benefit from that? And that's where health folks are very good at sort of shaping that conversation. And then, can we measure change? In Detroit and in most communities, environmental justice issues are primary. When we developed the action model, we developed issue categories to sort of get people thinking about, well, what are the issues in my community? And as you can see from Milwaukee's example, they came up with four issue categories that weren't necessarily our issue categories, which is absolutely what we want to see happen. Same thing in Baraboo. Their four issue categories were heavily focused on the environment because it's a more smaller city and a lot of rural influence to this new concept of an urban environment that they're building. In Detroit, the community is so educated on environmental issues. They left these issues and said, keep them. We have a lot, and this is a good framework to work in. So we had suggested environment, planning, community, safety, security. I'm not going to read to you, but you can see some of the suggested topics. And these are the topics they're going to use in Southwest Detroit in the action model. Liz had shown you the framework earlier. We take the four questions and make really just a little Excel or Word table and fill it in as we're working. In Milwaukee, we used big newsprint easels and then typed it up over lunch hour and then presented the framework at the end of our two-hour session, including lunch, so it was 2.5 hours. But basically, in one meeting, you can really start looking at what the issues are. We want to have that second meeting so we can say, are these the issues we want to focus on? Is everybody in agreement? Did we miss anything? Did everybody get a chance to speak? Some of the issues, and I'm just going to show you a couple because you'll kill me for going over the action model again and again and again, but there were many in Detroit, and one is soil contamination with arsenic and lead. And Michigan, we know, has some naturally occurring arsenic in groundwater and well water. But soil could be coming from other sources such as coal, former coal burning. So that was an issue. Can we measure? You know, we know that there's a redevelopment approach, maybe remediation. The health benefit is to remove exposures, improve the environment. Can we measure an immediate short-term measure so you can actually give something to your community in a matter of weeks? Get some soil sampling data. Typically, it exists. This is why in the development community, you have a city partner who understands where the data sets are and can share, or the health department. They also want to look at air pollution. We can access existing databases such as NOAA, National Oceanic Air Atmospheric Administration. They were here at the conference. I'm like, do you have anything for Detroit? And toxic release inventory. So we can access these data. They wanted to look at other issues such as increasing community capacity to interact with city council. This can be perceived as a barrier in a lot of communities. They don't feel they have an avenue to talk to the city. Well, Dr. Nathan had been taking a very active role. Now Robert Brown from the City of Detroit will be working with this project and leading the effort. He's from Southwest Detroit. They want to take an active role and increase this communication. We've all seen examples of what happens when you stop that communication and you lose a lot of trust with your community. Another issue is that Southwest Detroit has historically been an industrial hub, and they want to look at zoning, historical zoning practices. You know, what is that measure? We can look at zoning changes, and we can also do an overall pollution characterization. And that's an immediate response to the community. You can see where your baseline is. When we had our workshop, we addressed public health themes that we've discussed earlier. And we wanted to leave time at the end of this session. This is all of our contact information. You can email me if you want a copy of the report that we wrote for the 30th Street Corridor in Milwaukee. It has a lot of parallels to Detroit. And in Baraboo, the city is very active, and the community is very active. So they're taking the action model framework and putting it on their website. And for a federal agency, we said, you got to have a disclaimer on there. Do not cite. But they said, no, we'll find a way to do this. And we have found a way that the community has access every step of the way as soon as that framework with all 31 multi-part measures is placed into the website. And I do want to mention that the time frame for doing a project like this, if you have a really active development community, and we are taking a back seat so that we don't own the process, it can be months. So in Milwaukee, it was about 1 year, and then we had to go through agency clearance, so it took, you know, maybe a year and a half to actually hand them a report. In Baraboo, we're 2 or 3 months in. We started last January, January 28th. In February, I hope to travel, if there's no blizzard, back to Baraboo and say, let's have a party because we're done. We're putting a lot of effort in now to make these pilots very good so that other communities across the country won't need this level of support, and we're validating the action model so that after we do a couple more pilots, we can say here's what works, and it's actionable. You can measure change, and then we can release this. So we want to take questions. We wanted to finish early enough to take questions. And are there any questions?
Is this for the whole panel questions?
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you. Thanks.
I have a question according to the question. I just want to announce I'm the chair elected of the building of the department section, Dr. Shelby Wilson, and I've had it out surveys. Please evaluate the session. And so please put your name, your name is your badge ID, your session ID down so we need to hit the stadium for the continue to build the conference. And what I wanted to say is I want to hear from the panelists. If you need the survey, please raise your hands. I'll pass it out. I wanted from the panelists some of the challenges, any panelists, some of the challenges you had to overcome, and what were some of the lessons learned, because that's really important. So how can we replicate these models? We really need to understand the challenges, and how did you kind of overcome those challenges and barriers, and what are some of the lessons learned, best practices, and going through this process, this action model process that you've been doing in different areas. So any panelists can answer that question.
We'll all take turns.
Right. I just want to really quickly mention one thing that came up in Milwaukee, and it had to do with defining our development community. I want to make the point that it's very important that your development community have a say in who the development community is, because yes, we came up with a list at the very start of all the people we were going to contact, but then after we started inviting people to a meeting, we discovered that there were a bunch of different community groups. Milwaukee, the 30th Street corridor, runs through 11 different neighborhoods. And these were neighborhoods that had neighborhood community groups that we had not really heard of before. They were very, very small in some cases, or they didn't have a website. So just being open to having this be a living development community and growing and constantly building.
Slip, trip, and fall hazard. I'm an industrial hygienist, says Sharon. We noticed the stairs aren't all the way lit outside either, but this is what happens when you get engineer and scientists doing community work. We can't help but insert our nerdy backgrounds. I have not found the action model to be an impediment to communities. That's why we built it within a community, and it's intuitive, and it can be done by the community. So when we're looking at things like how many grocery stores are in the area, that's a great project for the Boys and Girls Club to go out and make a map and count the grocery stores, and they are doing public health, and now they get their families involved. And guess what else? It's a funding opportunity. So I can send grant announcements to the Boys and Girls Club in Baraboo and say, guess what? You know, they're looking for youth-based projects. And in fact, in Baraboo, the high school class is collecting the wildlife measures that they wanted to look at. They're also learning to use our site inventory tool, so they're getting some computer lab work. We lectured for 45 minutes, and they're off and running. In fact, today they're out in the field collecting wildlife data. And I also want to ask Danelle, who's new to our action model process, what she thinks about it and if she sees any impediments or barriers to communities.
Real quickly, I'm an advocate for informed, engaged citizenry. So I think the real key is to make certain that people that you bring to the table have the information and tools and resources so they can effectively engage and own the process. And if I've witnessed any challenges over the years in our work is that people come to the table sometimes, they don't really know the history, they may not have all the information, and they could be engaging in something that could result in further disproportionately impacting the community. So I would be careful to ensure that. But I do see opportunities, in particular for young people especially. I think that, for example, with the work that we do with our youth, we have a project called Youth on Patrol Against Pollution. But these are high school youngsters. They are at-risk youth that have really taken advantage of the opportunity to learn some things really scientifically and apply that to their real world experiences. And we're excited about the improvements and their grades and their commitment to their community. We engage them in actually photojournalism and doing a photo voice. Last year, they self-selected a project to study invasive species along the Detroit River, and really have provided some insight for the Port Authority, for example, in helping to find ways to mitigate the invasive species in that particular area. So these are young urban youth, and I think the sky is the limit when we involve young people.
We have about 10 more minutes for questions, so why don't you?
I really very nice. Thank you very much for the panel. I know one of the examples of the early speaker was the long-term cleanup was 400 years. And so I'm really anxious about who's financing the revisiting and the remonitoring of what is being projected for these sites that aren't really cleaned up.
Well, and I can answer that question because, you know, for some of those sites, those are Superfund sites. That's a negotiated, you know, legal agreement between the potentially responsible party, the US EPA, the Department of Justice, and the state. So on that scale of contamination, you know, that's bound by law. So that's not as much of an issue as, you know, a site that maybe, you know, is cleaned up to the standard of, you know, and then there's a property transfer. Or, as in the current case, you know, there were those agreements, but the economy has changed. Yeah. And so there was the viable business that was doing right by the community, but now they're out of business. So I think, you know, this will continue to be a challenge.
Yeah, I'm just talking about financing, the monitoring, and the commitment, you know, because it can't just be from the feds. It should be from the developer. The developer should put in his or her costs what it will take to monitor their cleanup.
Well, the property owner has responsibility for monitoring and maintaining engineering controls and institutional controls on a property. And the EPA also funds states to make sure they have parallel brownfields programs, one cleanup programs, so that they also monitor, maintain, and do IC tracking, EC tracking. So, you know, it isn't not under discussion and surveillance, but it's an important area that the community and the public health community need to be involved. You guys have the building code, you have habitability standards, you permit drinking water wells. If it's an area that drinking water is restricted, you need to understand our lingo for that long-term stewardship.
But they've never assessed the cost of reclaiming when they're doing their development. And it should be, when they're saying this is worth so much for me as a developer, one of the levels should be how much you're going to contaminate, how much you're going to protect people. That should be part of it.
And it is. It really is. So, but I think, you know, we all have costs that are calculable and we have costs that are incalculable. So, you know, but this is an important discussion to have because I think people need to understand how we come to the decisions we do. And not just brownfields, but Superfund, RCRA, all of our, you know, our cleanup programs.
I have a similar question. I'm not an environmental health person, so some of this is new to me. But the brownfield money, it comes from the feds, but where does it come from? Is it through litigation?
No, we are appropriated. Our law allows us to be appropriated up to $250 million a year. So Congress willing, we are giving out $70 million this year, and we hope it's at least $70 million next year. That's for our competitive grants, for assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup grants. They can go to government entities only. However, the revolving loan fund, that's the pool of capital, though they can make loans, no to low interest loans to the public and private sector to clean up sites. They have to repay it, and then there's a revolved principal that allow future loans and grants to be made to clean up sites.
I guess, Mike, if my undergraduates in political science and history, so forgive me. I guess my concern is we're talking about environmental justice, but we're talking about it in terms of, I know you said you didn't like the term victims, but that's the only word I can think of. But we're not talking about the perpetrators either, unless it's a Superfund site.
Well, but sometimes there isn't a perpetrator. You know, the owner of a company died. You know, this isn't the Superfund and the, you know, the malfeasance, the negligence, the dumping of the 5,000 drums in the back quarter. This is, you know, the gas station that mom and dad and grandpa and grandma owned, and it went out of business. You know, so, you know, if there's fault to be found, we find it. But it's expensive to find the fault. It's expensive to sue them. We want that, most of all, we want to protect public health and the environment. And if the answer is the city has to foreclose on the property because it's already abandoned and they can't pay their tax, you know, let's get the city to take over the property so that they can get the grant to help assess and clean it up, and we can put it back on the tax rolls. It's a positive, not a negative, and we can address the issue.
So when you're talking about the yeah, you can take contamination issue, do we have a lot of overlap between the Brownfield sites and the Superfund?
No. Superfund is like methyl ethyl death. We don't go there. You know, we're a little bit of dirty dirt.
Okay.
You know, it's...
Okay, that's reasonable. And then my other question from my public health side is, how do you define what a community is? And I didn't hear any sort of mention about tribes. It was state, federal, and local.
No, tribes are eligible for our funds, both the competitive, and they get the non-competitive state and tribal grants. So, yes, they're in the picture.
So one of the tribes that I represent that's on the Superfund side, though, would not
nope.
Be eligible?
Then you would talk to Sharon.
Okay.
Well, you talk to our Superfund program. You know.
Yeah, because they have resources. Right. In fact, to me, they may have more resources than the traditional brownfield sites in terms of the...
There's a lot of tribes that I think that would be very interesting.
Right. And I just wanted to add real quickly, one of the things I neglected to mention, I am a member of the Detroit Brownfield Redevelopment Authority. We fought really hard as a community person to be at that table because we were really concerned that it was that the process for redevelopment was very development driven. And was not focused on public health, wasn't focused on community benefits and those things. In fact, many times brownfield development resources were being utilized without the participation of community people. And so that's been a hard won fight, and we've been on it since its inception. And we think we help keep it process honest. And that's really critical in terms of cleanup. For us, we're always going to raise the issue of public health, the end use, and what, you know, will happen to the people who are on those properties. But I'll let other folks, the feds, handle the other questions.
Oh, okay.
Sure. Okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
10 years ago, when you first started working with the youth in Detroit.
Sure.
And I'm sure this question was asked me, others may have the same question. How do you get those youth who are out there doing their thing to come in and work on the environment, try to beautify their neighborhood?
First of all, we go where the youth are. We don't expect them to come to us. One really important thing for us, Sharon mentioned it when she described the breadth of NIHS programs. In terms of the consortium approach, I just want to highlight this because this has something to do with our youth work. We're members of actually three consortiums. We do the minority worker training through the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice out of Dillard. But we also, the bedrock of our program is called CHATS, our Community Hazard Awareness Training and Seminars. And we have used that as sort of our organizing tool. As a member of the Midwest Consortium for Hazardous Waste Worker Training, we've been there since the inception of DWJ. So my background is in occupational health and whatever, so I've been really involved in that from that angle. And sort of, so we've used curricula and shaped it in a way that reaches the community. So we have infiltrated schools. We have gone to churches. We have gone to block clubs. We have gone to community-serving organizations, youth-serving organizations. We don't try to change their agenda, but we bring this so that they can be enlightened, they can enhance the agenda, because environmental justice is such a broad thing. So as far as young people are concerned, they are excited about the potential once they learn that these hazards exist in their community, or maybe lead may be linked to violence in their community, and the violence, you know, is a social issue. They then have some hope about how they can make change, how they can contribute to change. We make certain that our young people get access to information about careers across the, across the board. So you can be an environmentalist as a teacher, you get as a lawyer, as a doctor, as an activist, an advocate, a political scientist. I mean, the scope of this is so huge. And because so many of our young people don't get exposed to this as an avenue, we make certain that that happens. We work with the University of Michigan through the Urban Research Center Board, and they do a lot of things around community-based participatory research, which, you know, I highly value. But one of the things, we don't like just being researched. And if young people, if they're looking at asthma and children and blah, 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 then I want our young people to go to visit the campus, talk with the scientists, participate in helping to design the projects. And as far as our organization, to remain true to that, we make certain that they're infiltrated in our programming. I mean, they're on our board of directors, our committees and activities. Young people are valued. And when we do that, they want to give back, and they're reaching out to their community. So it's a lot, but don't wait for them to come to you. They will not.
So, sorry, the lady in the back had a question. You had a question. So, sorry.
Sharon wanted to.
Okay.
I just wanted to briefly say that we find that, again, there are different programs dealing with hazardous waste and dealing with Superfund. We provide up to $35 million a year to clean up. Training and those type of things, so we have different avenues, and I'll be happy to share
it with you. Yeah. Well, we'll take one more question, but before we do, let's thank this panel today. It was, and all of you for your good questions. You were waiting to get a question? Sorry.
I just want to know if you have any examples from the Mid-South.
I guess the answer is yes. In terms with the action model or just brownfield grants in general?
Alabama count?
Yeah.
Okay. Billy Hewitt, the fire chief.
Tarrant, Alabama.
Has led a redevelopment effort. Okay. And we're featuring it in a book.
Were there other questions then? I guess we have, you know, a minute. Okay. You are eligible for Brownfield Grant, but I don't think I'm going to be able to keep Laurel from responding to this too.
We're starting a project in Indianapolis. There's a CARE grant and there is a Brownfields grant.
Yes. I'm aware of that. We did help with that a little bit, but there's so much more.
Yes.
Please talk to me, because we're going to Indianapolis to the Brownfields coordinator is Deborah Orr in Region 5. And we are working with Margaret Millard at EPA with the CARE grant, and they want to help. And one thing you can do is go to your grantee and say, I know you have funding. I'm going to ask you for $5,000 or $10,000 to do your community outreach.
And we talked about the health monitoring, but that's capped. The health department does not need to only do health monitoring. You can be involved in community involvement. You can be the board of the Brownfield grant. You can be involved in the planning process. You can be involved in shaping the redevelopment. So there is a provision in the law for the 10%. You need not be excluded only to that. And I think everybody, well, I particularly, but everybody sees the value in the public health agencies being involved in the Brownfields process. Barbara Sattler.
Yeah, I just wanted to suggest, my name is Barbara Sattler, and I do environmental health nursing, that I'd be happy to work with you through the public health nursing section here at the University of Maryland, where I am, to bring some environmental health programming to your public health nurses to provide a context for them to begin to understand those bridges between public health.